Good afternoon. I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:31 p.m. on Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Members present today are Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Geisel, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Wilson. We were expecting Senator Beckett today. He may show up. Today we will take public testimony and hear two bills, HB 186, Food Donations, by Representative Tallarico and staff, and Senate Bill 79, Opioids, Prescriptions, Database Licenses, by the Rules Committee on behalf of the Governor. And we have members from the Department of Health and Social Services here to testify on that bill and to give an overview. We'll first begin with HB 186, Version J, and we would like to welcome Representative Tallarico and his staff, Julie Morris, to the table to present this bill. You begin when ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Dave Tallarico. I'm the House Representative for District 6. I usually just describe that as the eastern portion of Alaska. But I really do appreciate the opportunity to bring HB 186 before you today. Mr. Chairman, HB 186 seeks to reduce the amount of wasted food in the state while increasing the amount of food donated to food banks and other charitable organizations. Nearly 15% of Alaskans fall into the category of food insecure individuals. Many businesses are currently donating excess food. However, many desire to do so but are not because of liability or perceived liability. Many charitable organizations do not receive sufficient food donations to feed the homeless and hungry, and that those without those charities, these folks won't have any way to eat. Recently, I actually had an opportunity to discuss this with someone from the rescue mission in Fairbanks, and just within the last month or so, they got to a point a couple of times where they actually run out of food, and then they have to make an attempt to go over to Costco and see if they can get their supplies to feed everyone. All of these charities and the people that that need this food would certainly benefit if we can generate more donated food. So HB 186 allows hotels, restaurants, and stores and other food donors who choose to donate all of their excess food, unsold food, or outdated food. They can give these to food banks or, as this would clarify within our statutes, charitable organizations, which isn't necessarily included right now, charitable organizations. We cover food banks well, but charitable organizations aren't necessarily in there. Another kind of a sweet spot in it for me, being a former municipal official, I was responsible for a solid waste facility. And within a solid waste facility, one of the things that you deal with that is probably not that pleasant for the employees is food waste. Municipalities really rely, a big expense that you'll have at your solid waste facility is consuming space. You try and make that, you try and crush everything down and get everything put away. So food waste, of course, consumes some space. It also attracts all of the wild animals in. So the less food that you have in there and the less of that smell that you have and that odor, the better. And you also have the bacteria issue later on. So this certainly won't eliminate it, but I do hope that it would ease some of the pressure for that. So I won't take up a lot of time, but I would urge your support for this bill would help reduce the amount of wasted food and increase the amount of donated food, which would decrease hunger in Alaska. One other thing that I really hope that we would do is a lot of our food doesn't have much of a shelf life. Some does. Some goes away pretty quickly, though. And it would be my hope that we would have this when it's contributed locally, that we would be able to use the stuff that is perishable right away for our local needs and continue to be able to warehouse and stock some of those things that we can distribute further out in Alaska. I know that happens in the interior occasionally. I know the Tanana Chiefs Conference works throughout all along the Yukon River and in some of our remote locations. And the more that more inventory that we have of food that we can ship out there, the better off we'll all be when that need arises. Occasionally, there's the Fairbanks Food Bank has an emergency food distribution set up so that when an emergency does arise, or it's getting close, and we can see it coming, that they have the ability to actually get that to people. And it would be my hope that if we're able to actually increase the stuff that we can use right there near the food bank, that we'll actually have more in supply so it could be distributed more widely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And if you would like, Julie Morris is here. She could run through the sectional analysis for you.
Yes, please. But before she does, I just want to acknowledge for the record that Senator Baggett came to join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Julie Morris, staff to Representative Tallarico. I would like to walk you through this sectional analysis for House Bill 186. Section 117 in Alaska Statute 17.20.345A amends by adding a charitable organization to statute next to food banks to be able to receive donated food from donors who may donate their food free from liability. In the same statute, B1, by adding a sentence clarifying that the labels referenced in this statute do not include the new label referenced in Section 2 of this bill, which requires heated donated food to be labeled. In B of the same statute, amends by adding a third bullet point allowing donors of the food to donate food with an expired date on it. And C, by adding charitable organization to statute along with food banks to be able to receive donated salmon from hatcheries. In Section 2, amends Alaska Statute 17.20.345 by adding a new section which allows donors of food to donate excess hot food to food banks and charities as long as they labeled it as previously heated food. Section 3 in Statute 17.20.346A by adding a charitable organization in statute next to food banks to be free from liability to donate received food to hungry individuals as long as they first inspect it and deem it fit for human consumption. B of that section, by adding charitable organization in statute next to food banks to be free to receive donated food with an expired date on it. And we move on to Section 4, amends Alaska Statute 17.20.347(1) by adding delicatessen, restaurant, hotel, and store under the definition of donor. In 2 of that section, by deleting part of the definition of a food bank so as to separately define a nonprofit organization in the new section. Section 5 amends by adding three new definitions, namely 1, the charitable organization means a nonprofit organization that provides food without charge to individuals who do not have money to pay for food or who do not have homes. Number 2, food includes unsold hot food. And 3, nonprofit organization means an organization recognized by the state or federal government as a nonprofit organization. That completes your sectional analysis on the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Are there any questions from committee members for the bill sponsor at this time? Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tallarico, has there been, or your staff, has there been any opposition from any of the food banks or nonprofits to the elements in HB 186?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we haven't had any, as far as I'm aware of, we haven't had any opposition to it. I will tell you that we did have one comment in opposition. Of the many comments that we had, we've only had one comment that was in opposition to the bill, and it was not connected with a food bank or a charitable organization.
Follow up, Senator.
What was their concern?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, they, I need to word this appropriately. They were somewhat convinced that this was going to be incredibly dangerous, or the intent was to make this incredibly dangerous for people to consume bad food. Title 18 of the Alaska Administrative Code, which is kind of known as the Food Code, the Alaska Food Code, there are no changes to the code at all when it comes to the handling, preparation, inspections by the Department of Environmental Conservation. All of those stipulations are still in place with this. Yes. So none of the monitoring changes for this at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Von Hoff.
Thank you, through the chair. So it says HB 186 will allow hotels, restaurants, stores, and other food donors. So I'm assuming that could be potentially private individuals. And the only reason why I ask is that I actually thought that that's happening now, because I thought that if there are events where there is significant excess food, like a cookie party or something along that line, you bring those to, for in our neighborhood, Beans Cafe. Does that occur now already?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it does occur. It occurs definitely through private donors. Mm-hmm. And I'll just relay the story that while I was here in Juneau, part of my inspiration for this was to see hot food come out of one of the retailers here one evening when I was shopping. And just out of curiosity, I had wondered where they were headed. And they were headed to the trash container, which was locked, and dumped the hot food into the container and locked it, because they said that the company's concern was for liability. Mm-hmm. They would much prefer to give it away, but they were concerned that there would be a liability involved, even though we did have a discussion about the Good Samaritan law, which is a law that really kind of says that if someone is in peril, yeah, that you have the ability to assist them. I guess their question is, when are people in peril? Only when the food bank is completely empty are people in peril, or only when there is absolutely nothing available? So there's been that little bit of concern that they're always kind of open to the liability. For me personally, it was kind of a tragic event to see what I would have guessed probably about 400 pounds of prepared food go into the dumpster and then mm-hmm. padlocked. Due to the liability concern. So even though I'm not wholly convinced that there's a liability there, but I'm hoping this is inspiration to absolutely remove that thought from anyone's mind, and if they have that and they have the ability to donate and they choose to do so, that they would.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. And I liked your comment that it does not change in the back end the processes that's in place now and the testing and to making sure that the food is fit. I just want to make sure that I'm certainly aware that the food bank is going to think about the additional personnel if there need to be to sift through hopefully more volumes of food, the storage capability, their garbage or refuse capacity if needed, as well as, in the event of, you said meat and dairy. I say meat and dairy, but you're going to say that that's going to be dealt with in the normal fashion anyway. So hopefully that will be a good problem to have if the food bank has to hire an additional persons to handle this volume.
See another following questions from the committee. We'll open this up for public testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau like to testify for HB 186? Seeing none, we'll go to the phone line where we have Ms. Samantha Kirsten from Fairbanks. Samantha, if you can identify yourself for the record and any affiliations, and you may begin your testimony when ready. And just plan for about 2 minutes.
Okay, good. I'm surprised to be able to testify again because I have a letter already and have testified once. But I thought the line was muted, but thank you. I mostly just want to tell you thank you. My job is at the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. I've worked here for 27 years, and yes, we do have the Good Samaritan Act, but in fact, as Representative Tallarico says, that we need to have a little more comfort for the people who donate food to us, especially the commercial grocers, and this will do that. I am so pleased that he noticed the waste of food and that he's taken action on it and that it's gotten this far in this session. So my duty today is just to say thank you very much. It is something that is important for food banks, and I appreciate the time that you've spent on it.
Right. Thank you, ma'am. All right. With that, we'll close public testimony. See no other folks online or in the room that are willing to testify for HB 186. What is the do we have a motion to move this bill out of committee?
Thank you. I move House Bill 186, version J as in Juliet, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing none, we'll take an at ease signed documents. Back on record. At this time, we'll take up Senate Bill 79. Before us, we have the CS for Senate Bill 79, Labor and Commerce Version O. Presenting for the administration today is Dr. Jay Butler. Welcome, Dr. Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And assisting, do we have Stacey Carley here
today? Yes.
From the Department of Law, and also available is Sarah Chambers from Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, if there are also questions for her as well. So you guys may begin when you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, and thank you to all members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services, and I just want to start by thanking you for the opportunity to speak to you on SB 79. The opioid epidemic continues. We ain't solved this one yet. More than 90 of our fellow Alaskans died of an opioid overdose in 2016. That's well over twice the number of Alaskans who died of AIDS at the peak of the HIV epidemic. And that number represents nearly 1 in 40 of all Alaskans who died last year. And these deaths oftentimes occurred among our young people. Two-thirds of opioid overdoses involved a prescription opioid. The majority of people who use heroin and other illicit opioids in recent years report that they first became hooked when using prescription opioid painkillers, often on the advice of a trusted and generally well-meaning provider. I generally refer people to the medical literature, but I'm going to do something unusual and refer you to iTunes. And I do not have any financial relationship with any hip-hop artist. But if you haven't listened to Macklemore's Drug Dealer, if you don't want to spend $1.99, Google the lyrics. I think it's a very interesting essay on the experience of how someone who uses prescription opioids can progress to heroin. And let me just say, I get a very different reaction when I'm speaking to teenagers and bring that song up, because I see a lot of nods around the room. But Alaska is responding to the opioid epidemic through community coalitions, action by our citizens, and even through state government. Last time I spoke to you was on SB 91, and I just want to thank this committee, Mr. Chairman, particularly your work to get that through. And we now have the authority to be able to increase access to the life-saving drug naloxone. Nearly 5,000 of these kits have been distributed over the past 2 months through public health centers, recovery support programs, law enforcement officers, and others who may be likely to be present when someone has overdosed. However, while these kits can be life savings, they don't solve the problem. They don't support people who are in recovery, who desperately want to continue in sobriety, and they don't address some of the underlying drivers behind the opioid epidemic. SB 79 adds to the state's multifaceted approach to addressing the epidemic and aligns with the current science on pain management as well as addiction medicine, based on some of the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. Surgeon General, a number of professional groups, including the American College of Physicians, as well as the best practices and learned experiences from the Veterans Administration's Opioid Safety Initiative. SB 79 can be viewed as addressing three areas that my mnemonic is it's the three P's. It is patients, providers, and the prescription drug monitoring program. The bill does two things for patients who wish to limit or eliminate their exposure to prescription opioids. The bill provides for an opioid advance directive as a communication tool between a patient and a provider that can be included in the medical record. The directive makes it clear that the patient does not wish to receive opioid medications. It's purely voluntary and is revocable. I have to admit, as a provider, I wouldn't have necessarily thought of this as something that was necessary or useful, but what I hear from a number of people in recovery, as well as their families, is that too many providers don't fully understand the destructive impact of opioids. For some people, opioids are the wrong drug at any dose, at any time. The bill also protects healthcare providers from liability risk by including a waiver of civil liability if an opioid is withheld when a directive is in place, and also provides civil liability protection if an opioid is inadvertently administered when a directive is in place, as may happen in an emergency situation. The second issue for patients is the bill provides in state statute the authority of patients to request a partial fill of an opioid prescription if they do not wish to receive, if they wish to receive a smaller number of pills than what is prescribed, and reinforces the authority of the pharmacist to honor the partial fill request without the need to immediately void the remaining portion of the prescription, as provided under the Federal Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016. The bill addresses two areas related to providers. The first is relates to the amount of opioids that are dispensed. Analysis released earlier this year from a variety of types of data have shown that persons who receive larger first-time prescriptions of opioids are more likely to become chronic opioid users and thus a greater risk of dependency or addiction in the subsequent months and years. This increased risk is particularly for first-time prescriptions for more than a 5 to 7 day supply. An analysis of Alaska Medicaid claims last year indicated that roughly half of all first-time opioid prescriptions that had claims in the Medicaid system were for more than a 15-day supply. Even if the drugs are not used, they become a source for diversion and misuse in the communities. Another analysis that came out of Dartmouth that was published in the Annals of Surgery recently looked at the prescribing practices for patients in the post-op period and found there was a wide degree of variation, anywhere from no drugs to 120 pills, and that overall nearly 75% of all these drugs were never taken and remained in the patient's home. The I wish I could say this is, well, that's Dartmouth, that's not Alaska. We don't have as clear a data here, but certainly anecdotally it suggests that it happens here too. A school nurse recently related to me the story of a student returning to school after arthroscopy. He did just what he's supposed to do and checked in with her and gave her his prescription meds, and he had 120 Vicodin prescribed by his provider. Someone else just a couple days ago had contacted me about our drug disposal bags and wanted several of them. And when I asked why, she described getting nearly 250 opioids after hip replacement therapy. And basically her pain was managed within the first 48 hours. So she had so many pills that even one bag wasn't adequate to dispose of the extras. SB 79 proposes that these first-time prescriptions for acute pain be limited to no more than 7-day supply to define a safer standard of care. We recognize that opioids are appropriate for treatment of some conditions and for some people, so the limit allows a waiver based on the provider's professional judgment for severe acute pain, chronic pain, cancer pain, palliative care, or this being a big state where people oftentimes have to travel to see a provider, waivers for the logistics of travel so that people do not need to travel long distances just to get a refill of their medications. The dispensing limit of 7 days, though, mainly requires that it be documented in the medical record why a greater number is needed. So it puts a stop check into the process to make sure that providers as well as patients are considering whether a larger amount are needed. And this is somewhat stealing a page from what we've learned in antimicrobial stewardship over the past 20 years, and the concept of accountable justification has been shown to improve the quality of the use of antimicrobial drugs. The second aspect relating to providers is the bill authorizes professional boards to require that part of the currently required continuing education credits be designated for pain management or basics of addiction medicine. For example, as a physician, every 2 years I have to document that I have at least 40 hours of continuing medical education credit, and the intention is that at least 2 of those hours be designated for either pain management or addiction medicine. The focus here may get a little confused, because while this is an opioid bill, I think it's important to recognize that addiction is not a molecule-specific problem, and it's very prevalent. Nearly 10% of adults have some type of substance use disorder, so no matter who you are, if you are a healthcare provider, you're going to be interacting with people with substance use disorders, or oftentimes unknown to us, people who are in recovery who require special care. I've been in this job long enough, I feel like I need to say a former provider, but as someone who was, until not so recently, taking care of infectious disease patients, I was not dispensing insulin and managing people's diabetes, but I certainly needed to understand the concepts of diabetes and how what I was doing could interact with their disease as well as other therapies to manage diabetes. It's important that we recognize that addiction is also a chronic health condition that requires that kind of awareness throughout the medical profession. The science of substance dependency and addiction is also evolving fast, and it's unfortunately an area of medicine that I think too many of us have ignored, and I'll be first among those to say I have ignored that for too long. There's concerns may be raised about the cost of continuing medical education credit. I found that there are a number of good, free, online CME courses. One is put out by the American Medical Association, and I love the title, A Primer on Opioid Morbidity and Mortality, What Every Prescriber Needs to Know. And I thought it really stood out to me that the emphasis is on every prescriber, not just people who manage pain frequently. The CDC has also put out a number of CME programs that focus on how to manage chronic pain patients that may be physically dependent on opioids or may be addicted. Some of these modules even provide specialty maintenance of certification credit. The scope of pain module put out by Boston University was one that I went through, and I was very pleased to find I picked up two credits for my internal medicine certification as well. And finally, just in terms of doing a search, I haven't been through all of them, but I found at least 30 different options, and that certainly would be something that we would be wanting to do, to look at some of those so that we might be able to endorse those as meeting those needs. The third P is further enhancements to the prescription drug monitoring program. The PDMP is not a panacea. It doesn't solve all our problems, and I want to be very upfront about that. But it can be a useful clinical tool, but it's only a tool that works if it's actually used. Not being a natural fan of the PDMP or any other type of administrative requirements. Yes, sir.
Give the full name, not the acronym.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I thought once I had defined it, I could go back. But I'll continue to use the – yes, okay, very good. Well, as I was saying, I'm not a natural fan of prescription drug monitoring programs, but over the past year, I've certainly paid a lot of attention to the emerging data after the passage of SB 74, I've been impressed with some of the emerging data that shows that there are reductions in overdose death rates in states that have robust prescription drug monitoring programs, and even that there's been a decline in Medicaid expenditures after requiring providers use the database. SB 79 has three primary refinements to the Alaska prescription drug monitoring database. First of all, it authorizes the Department of Commerce to issue regular unsolicited reports to prescribers. These are sometimes known as report cards, which isn't a very positive way to describe them, but that is a term that is used. Another is peer self-comparison reports. And again, this has taken a page from what we've learned on how to encourage more judicious and appropriate use of antimicrobial drugs. These would be issued to all providers who are registered with the database and would provide non-punitive feedback to each provider on his or her prescribing habits in comparison to that of their peers. It really is intended to be a self-education tool. And in considering this bill, this was actually a concept that was suggested by some providers as a way to use the database as an educational tool and a self-check. Again, based on some of the experience we've had in various healthcare systems to improve the use of antimicrobial drugs. Roughly 10 states have similar programs in place. Second, the utility of the prescription drug monitoring program depends on timely data. Under last year's SB 74, the reporting interval for pharmacies went from monthly to weekly. SB 79 proposes to further increase the reporting interval to daily, as has already been done in 25 other states. We recognize that this is an administrative burden, particularly for some of our smaller and more rural pharmacies that may not have the degree of automation that the chains or the larger pharmacies have. Therefore, this part of SB 79 has an implementation date in mid-2018 to provide as much time as possible to be able to help particularly the smaller pharmacies adopt to the weekly updates before advancing to what really has become the standard in the majority of states. And finally, SB 79 clarifies a point that came up during discussions on SB 74 last year and clearly defines the role and responsibility of veterinarians with active drug enforcement agency numbers, and defines the legal authority to prescribe opioids that they must register for the prescription drug monitoring program. Well, I don't know how common it is in Alaska. We've certainly heard reports from the lower 48 of people who've unfortunately intentionally injured an animal to be able to receive opioids from a veterinarian. So this measure is a way to make sure that veterinarians don't become the go-to for opioids that could be misused or diverted. In addressing the opioid epidemic in Alaska, it's going to take all of us. The I'm sorry if I'm going on too long, but I always like to quote Hal Rogers from Kentucky, who has certainly spent time for a number of years now trying to deal with this problem in his home district. When he was chair of U.S. House Appropriations, I think he said it well. There's no silver bullet to stem the tide of prescription drug abuse in America. The lack of an easy solution requires all of us to treat the opioid crisis as a nonpartisan issue and adopt an all-hands-on-deck approach. SB 79 is part of Alaska's call for all-hands-on-deck to support our fellow Alaskans living in recovery and reduce the number of persons who become newly dependent on these medications while supporting the care of those who truly need them. I'd be happy to take questions. I also would be happy if you'd like a more detailed walkthrough of the sectional analysis to turn it over to Stacy Crayley or Sarah Chambers, whatever is your pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
Just a brief walkthrough of the bill, if you could, please, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And again, up here with me is Assistant Attorney General Stacy Crayley. We have a sectional walkthrough that I believe you have in paper form. So we'll just go through the bill and use that as our tool to do so. So the bill starts out with sections 1 and 2 amending Board of Dental Examiners statutes to require the board to adopt regulations to include continuing education hours for pain management and opioid misuse and addiction. Section 3 amends the Board of Dental Examiner statutes to give them the disciplinary authority to take action on a license if the board finds a licensee has prescribed or dispensed an opioid in excess of the maximum dosage authorized under 0836355 or done other activities that relate to misuse of prescription drugs. Section 4 adds a new section to the Board of Dental Examiner statutes, the limit that I just spoke of, limiting to a 7-day supply for an adult or minor. And as Dr. Butler said, this gives the that restriction gives the provider to use the opportunity to use his or her professional judgment to determine whether a greater than 7-day supply is warranted and to document that appropriately. Section 5 amends the board statutes to define opioid. Section 6 moves to the medical board and does essentially the same thing. Sections 6 through 13 all speak to continuing education on pain management and opioid use and addiction for those license types that have the DEA numbers and the authority to prescribe controlled substances. Section 14 gives the medical board that same disciplinary authority over a licensee should an investigation find out that they have violated these laws. Section 15 adds a new section to medical board statutes, also limiting the dosage of an opioid prescription to 7 days and also giving the provider the opportunity to prescribe more if in his or her judgment it's deemed necessary and to record that prescription. Section 16 amends medical board statute for drugs without a prescription drugs without a physical examination. This regards telemedicine, and it provides that the board may not impose disciplinary sanctions on a physician for prescribing, dispensing, or administering a controlled substance if the requirements in the new section AS0864363 regarding professional competence under section 12 of this document are met. So that amends statute that was included that was adopted last year regarding telemedicine. Section 17 defines opioid in medical board statutes. Section 18 through 20 move on to define continuing education requirement for advanced practice registered nurses. Section 21 also imposes the 7-day supply through the nursing board on advanced practice registered nurses and gives the provider that same leeway to use his or her judgment and record that decision. Section 22 further defines opioid in nursing board statutes. Section 23 through 25 speaks to continuing education changes within the board of optometry, again requiring, as all the other boards, education and pain management and opioid misuse and addiction as it pertains to that practice as a requirement of licensure. Section 26 provides the Board of Examiners and Optometry the ability to impose disciplinary sanctions on a licensee for those same reasons. Section 27 is a technical fix. It removes the DEA registration number requirement from pharmacists to register with the PD, and P pharmacists don't get DEA numbers. However, that was included in the bill, so this is just a fix to remove that. Section 28 amends Board of Pharmacy statutes to add a new section to allow the pharmacist filling a prescription for Schedule 2 or 3 controlled substances to dispense a lesser quantity than prescribed at the request of the individual for whom the prescription is written. So Dr. Butler spoke to this, but when a prescriber provides an amount and the amount of prescription to be dispensed and the patient says that they actually would like to start off with a lower amount, the pharmacist can fill that lower amount and then gives that flexibility for that person to cease there or to come back and continue the remainder of that prescription. Sections 29 through 30 pertain to the Board of Veterinary Examiners, again cleaning up some of the clarity, making clear from SB 74 last year, as Dr. Butler mentioned. Section 29 requires the Board of Veterinary Examiners to identify resources and develop educational materials to assist licensees in identifying an animal owner who may be at risk for abusing or misusing an opioid. So rather than the pain management CE, that's the parallel for the veterinary board. And then Section 30 speaks to the discipline provided to that board for, again, misuse of a controlled substance. Section 31, getting away a little bit from those specific board statutes, this section is the voluntary non-opioid directive, which Dr. Butler spoke about, allowing an individual to execute a directive stating they do not wish to receive opioids and removes or exempts the licensing board and licensee from civil and criminal liability if that directive isn't followed. Section 32 and 33 again move to the PDMP, Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and exclude correctional facilities from the requirements of utilizing the PDMP, I'm used to saying the acronym, Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, when the inmate is in the residence, in the facility. However, the PDMP must be reviewed and utilized when that inmate is being released. If they're prescribed opioids upon release, that must be used at that time. It also gives flexibility to emergency rooms, exempting them if they're prescribing less than a 24-hour supply of opioids. Section 34, as Dr. Butler mentioned, moves the use of the prescription drug monitoring database from weekly to daily. Section 35 states that the information contained in the prescription drug monitoring program can be shared with federal, state, and local law enforcement upon presentation of a valid search warrant or court order. So that information is confidential unless presented with those documents allowing release. Section 36 clarifies the role of the pharmacist and the practitioner. The pharmacist is required to submit information into the database while the practitioner is required to review it to make sure those actions are clear. 37 requires the Board of Pharmacy to notify the Board of Veterinary Examiners when a practitioner registers with the database. Again, another cleanup from the other boards having that requirement in SB 74 last year. Section 38 is the unsolicited notification from the Board of Pharmacy to a practitioner's licensing board if a patient has received one or more prescriptions for controlled substances in quantities with a frequency or with a frequency inconsistent with generally recognized standards of safe practice. And this is a change slightly. There's an element of this already in place where a patient may be red flagged for hitting some thresholds that the Board of Pharmacy has set, so that helps communicate in between pharmacists and practitioners when some of those red flag thresholds have been met. That is, again, confidential and must also be provided to the practitioner. This is hand-in-hand with the report card section, which we'll get to in just a moment. Sections 39 and 40 are cleanups, changing to a daily from a weekly basis and updating the definition of opioids. Section 41 is that report card where practitioners can receive a pretty snazzy review of their prescribing habits as compared to their peers. I've seen some examples of those as an aside, and they're really informative and really helpful. This section also it speaks to the exemption of inpatient pharmacies and emergency rooms, exempting them from the review and submission requirements of the prescription drug monitoring program when they're dispensing no more than 24-hour supply of opioids upon discharge. Section 42 gives the Commissioner of Health and Social Services the ability to adopt regulations to administer and implement the Voluntary Non-Opioid Directive Act. Section 43 provides a July 2018 effective date for various sections, repealing some of those. We have quite a few effective date changes to kind of keep things aligned with SB 74. Section 44 gives Department of Commerce and Economic Development the ability to draft regulations to implement changes to the PDMP prior to the effective date. We want to be ready when the effective date comes. And then the remainder of sections 45 through 53 all pertain to effective dates. 45 through 50 align again with SB 74, which becomes effective July 17 of this year. So we want this to align with that effective date. Section 51 is the moving from weekly to daily requirement for pharmacists that Dr. Butler spoke of, giving them an extra year to become compliant, get that figured out. And then the advanced directive section under 52 is a has an effective date of July 1, 2019. All other sections have an immediate effective date. So thank you for your patience with that walkthrough, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, I have a question, Bill. Senator Machicki.
I think it's a simple question. I noticed the connection with the seven-day supply for most of the providers, and it's probably there, but I didn't notice it for the veterinarians. Am I missing something? Is there a maximum supply range for vets as well? And how's that connection made in the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I know that optometrists, speaking to, there were two sections. One was optometrists. They already have a four-day limit in statute. Stacy, do you know if there's a limit to veterinarians?
For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law through the Chair, Senator Michicki. There is a similar provision within the bill as to a seven-day limit for veterinarians currently. That's not included in the bill.
Follow-up, Senator?
So on the books right now, there's a seven-day limit to an opioid in Schedule 1, or, and when we're through here, 3A controlled substances, there is a seven-day limit on the books, and currently in active statute.
Through the Chair, Senator Michicki, no, the seven-day limit is being adopted in this legislation. There is other boards, as Ms. Chambers mentioned, may have other limits, and there's other guidelines that boards may follow, but this specific seven-day limit is as to the boards that we've identified as having the ability to prescribe opioids. The seven-day limit is contained in this legislation.
Okay. I will keep looking. I didn't see the connection to veterinarians. I saw it to the others, so I could be other than the four-day difference. But
no, I think it's an omission in this bill.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
I was just going to clarify Senator Michicki's question. I think he did identify an omission. Thank you.
I have just a general question. How many pills is a seven-day supply? We just say seven-day supply, but we don't say sort of a number of...
Bring the doctor up.
Yeah. For the record, again, this is Jay Butler. Mr. Chairman, it depends on the medication. So it's going to be variable depending on whether it's a short-acting opioid or the more extended-release medications would be a smaller number of pills. Okay. So it will depend on the labeling for the dosing interval.
Yeah. And I guess when we have a patient that has been sort of red flagged by the database or notified to the practitioner sort of in their report card, will the patient also be notified that they can either be in danger of their own health or safety as well, or is it just for the notification to the prescriber and to the pharmacies?
Mr. Chairman, this is Sarah Chambers, and the notification, patients are able to request their history and their information at any time. The idea behind the practitioner receiving that notification is to have the option of notifying the patient, making sure that that patient-practitioner relationship is maintained. So the patient doesn't automatically receive notification, but they can request that record at any time.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Butler, in the letters I've been receiving that have opposed this bill, and there have been a number, they've all talked about the shortened time period. You mentioned in the sectional analysis and in your overview that the bill allowed for opportunities for those who suffer from lifetime chronic pain to potentially exceed these 7-day prescription amounts. And the most recent letter I received was from April 23rd, so I'm just wondering, are those additions that have been made to the bill since then, or is that the original language of the bill?
Senator Begich, this for the record, Jay Butler again. Senator Begich, through the chair, no, sir, that was part of the original bill, too, and that does seem to be a very frequent misunderstanding. So I'd want to stress it's not potential waivers. The bill does provide for the opportunity for those waivers. So, again, it's basically a stop check and the accountable justification so that the provider is, as well as the patient, is documenting in the medical record why a larger supply is needed.
So follow-up, Senator Begich.
So if I'm receiving a report card and I'm a provider who has a number of chronic pain clients, I'm going to have a bad report card potentially, right?
Senator Begich, through the chair, you will be prescribing at a higher number than your peers if they are not pain providers. But again, this is not punitive, so it is intended to be able to provide that opportunity for the provider to acknowledge that, for instance, if they are an anesthesiologist who specializes in pain management or a palliative care provider, they're going to be on the higher end of that spectrum. If indeed, if this were a larger state and we had enough providers to be able to stratify it out by specialty, that would be a better way to do it. But I think we have to do what we can do best with the state we live in.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to be sure it doesn't have a dampening effect on providing relief and not creating more obstacles for those with chronic pain. And I think you've addressed that, so hopefully it won't become one. Let's put that on the record. But also the last question I have is Senator Michicki brought up a very good point, which is it seems to be an omission that the veterinary limit is there. Is that something that we need to correct?
Senator Begich, through the chair, I have to say I would need to think about that for a few minutes. I think one of the, since Senator Michicki pointed that out, I think one of the challenges that I was trying to sort through was that in the question that Senator Wilson raised about what is a seven-day limit varies in humans primarily on the type of drugs. It may be a lot trickier in veterinary medicine given the wide range of size of your patients as well as potential and interspecies variation. So I would really need to think about that. The concept makes a lot of sense, but I'm not sure if there may be some details that I haven't considered yet.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. I will also have this bill in finance for the next committee of reference, and we'll have some time to evaluate that. But I, considering the spirit of the bill and the exposure, you gave a couple of examples of how some Alaskans have chosen to obtain their opioids through veterinarians. I think it's something that we should deal with, but let's take a little time to understand that and get the right amendment in finance.
Mr. Chairman, this is Sarah Chambers. I just wanted to add that since we regulate the Board of Veterinary Examiners, that would be a good question for me to go back and pose to that board.
Thank you. And as you're giving it to the next committee referral, if we can also just send it to our office as well, so if committee members that aren't on a finance can also get that answer or be in that looped as well.
Happy to.
Thank you. I think I have another question. It was just a general thought here for Dr. Butler. When you give the additional additional time or additional prescriptions for folks that are outside, it sort of gives the general requirements that any quantity needed to treat patients' medical conditions for chronic pain, that the licensee should document the medical records, the triggering prescription for the opioid and why that's needed. Should that just be a general statement for anyone, that any prescriber, just to document why the opioid prescription is needed? And so should that just be generally for every?
Mr. Chairman, Jay Butler for the record again. I understand exactly what the point that you're making, and I think in general that is the spirit of what we're trying to do, although we are also trying to keep the administrative burden as small as possible. I think ideally it makes a lot of sense that every opioid prescription should have a description of the justification. The focus that we're having here, though, is to really try and limit the prescriptions that we think are the most potentially dangerous, which would be the larger dispensings, the larger number of pills.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And speaking on the costs, do you feel that this bill and the components may add the additional administrative burden for the prescribing physicians and prescribing practitioners?
Mr. Chairman, I think in terms of looking at the potential cost, there certainly is time required in documenting things in the medical record. I do hearken back to one of my clinical mentors who used to drill into us that our care was only as good as our documentation. So I would encourage all providers that good care really is based in good documentation, which is not just communication with other providers, but because sometimes we're very busy, it helps us to remember what we were thinking the last time we were together with that patient. I think in terms of CME requirements, there are plenty of free options available. We're not imposing new requirements. We're just earmarking some of the ones that are currently required that they focus on this area that I think there's evidence it may be a bit of a deficiency in the general knowledge of many providers who are not really focused on taking care of patients who struggle with addictions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to add on to what Dr. Butler was saying to speak to your question, members of the Pharmacy Board in discussing this and other bills have who are sort of mom-and-pop pharmacy owners have also mentioned that the expense to pharmacies can vary widely depending on what market choice you make in software and reporting styles. The chair of the board indicated that he found it to be very minimal in his mom-and-pop operation to make that move from daily to weekly. Again, that was a choice to go with something less expensive. So that's just a little bit of feedback we had heard from some of the pharmacy community that we spoke with the board and wanted to make sure that people knew that there were options out there.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Geisel.
Yes, you know, well, actually both, Ms. Chambers and Dr. Butler. One of the things I've thought about with the PDMP is perhaps having a small registration fee so that those of us that are registering with that are actually helping offset some of the cost. I don't know if you've considered any of that.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, you must have a crystal ball because we are just about to send you and your colleagues notification of proposed regulations to administer such a fee. It's scheduled to be very minimal compared to all the other fees that we might opt to charge. This does take the onus off of the pharmacists who have been bearing the weight of the PDMP because they were the ones required to use it. We also have a fantastic and have for several years a fantastic partnership with the Department of Health and Social Services in obtaining two grants so far, with a third that we just completed application for to obtain federal funding to expand and add some of these things like the report card functionality to the PDMP. So we are trying to keep the cost low to prescribers and pharmacists, but appreciate your acknowledgement that there's a share to be had among everyone, not just the pharmacists, in expenses incurred by the PDMP. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just add Jay Butler again. And part of those conversations between our departments have also talked about customer service, that the service that providers who use the PDMP are getting is good.
Follow up, Senator Geisel?
No, thank you.
And with that was sort of my question that I asked. My last question was upon the cost sort of increasing for the users. That we're starting to charge or having more time for providers to implement this or fees associated, that they're just going to pass that burden on to the end user, the customers. And that's something I definitely don't want to see. I think our healthcare costs are high enough, and I don't want to give providers another reason to raise their rates for users that are going for just for the routine checkups or the chronic pain users, to have them have to burden the costs of this. Or less providers wanting to enter into chronic pain management, because that's sort of seen the decrease in those providers as well. All right. Seeing no other further questions, we will open public testimony. Thank you for presenting. We'll first go to the Dillingham LIO and talk to Jonathan Larson. And if you can introduce yourself for the record and plan for 2 minutes for your testimony, Mr. Larson.
Good afternoon, Senator Wilson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jonathan Larson. I am from Dillingham, Alaska. I have seen the opioid epidemic firsthand in my community. I was addicted to opioids for 10 years, starting with prescription opioids, leading into heroin use for the last 4 years. I am now sober and would like to share a little bit of my experience to help effect change and to fight this epidemic. I tried opioids for the first time at age 15. My thought was that it comes from a doctor, so it must be harmless. I was not prescribed these pills, but a friend of mine had a 30-day supply and offered me a few at a small price. This quickly grew into a habit that I never thought twice about because, again, they came from a doctor. When I was 18, I broke my arm and got a prescription. Not once was I told how addictive they are. By the time I was 19, I had a daily habit that took over my life. 2 weeks after my 19th birthday, my older brother died of an opioid overdose. I was so deep into my addiction that this wasn't enough to get me to quit. This went on for 2 years until the pills weren't enough anymore and I couldn't afford them. This is when I started using heroin. I know a lot of people in my community that use heroin, and almost every one of them started with prescription opioids. Never did I think that a small pill would lead me down the road to heroin use. After all, it was prescribed by a doctor at a hospital, handed out by a pharmacy, all people with much higher levels of education than me. I don't want to take away any personal responsibility on my part, but had there been only a 7-day supply prescribed, maybe that first pill I took not made it into my hands. Had a doctor informed me of how addictive opioids are when I broke my arm, I may have made the choice not to take them. This epidemic is tearing apart my community, and a lot needs to be done. This bill is a step in the right direction. I'd like to see this bill passed. I'd be the first to sign up for this program. I also believe this bill can help prevent people from going down the path of addiction that I have been on. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Next, we'll go to Dan Nelson in Fairbanks. Mr. Nelson, please state your name for the record and any affiliation.
Yeah, this is Dan Nelson. I'm director of pharmacy at Tannenbaum Chiefs Conference up here in Fairbanks, and I'm a practicing pharmacist. I'd like to thank you, Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today. I'll make my comments brief. First of all, I'd just like to thank everyone that's worked on this bill, from the senators, representatives, and members of the governor's administration for the various improvements from this original bill. I think as the previous public testifier spoke, this is a very important bill. It's I don't think the epidemic level can be understated, so I would say that this is very important. As a pharmacist, though, I know that there was some confusion with Senate Bill 74 that this has a lot of tie-ins to from last year's legislative session, and there's still some question as to the definition of a practitioner, particularly in Section 36. I would like some intent language put into this bill regarding the responsibilities of a practitioner versus a pharmacist. To me, when you look at Section 44 and it defines practitioner, it still has the same language that was caused all sorts of problems with Senate Bill 74 for the pharmacy community and a lot of consternation for the pharmacy community. So other than that, I would again like to thank everyone for all their diligence and hard work on this bill. And I do agree that this is definitely a step in the right direction. And thank you, Chairman Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next on the phone, we have Michael Carlson. Mr. Carlson, if you can identify yourself for the record and any affiliation, you may begin when ready.
Yes, my name is Michael Carlson. I am the chair of the MAPSU Opioid Task Force. And thank you, Senator Wilson, for this opportunity to give public testimony regarding SB 79. The question for us in the Valley is, why is this bill so important? The gentleman earlier that testified from Dillingham had a very impactful story. 80% of heroin users start with pain opioid pills. 75% of those individuals get those pills from their parents, friends, and grandparents. What has happened in the last 5 years is that we have seen a spike in heroin. In the year 2016, we had 128 overdoses in the state, drug overdoses. 40% of those were specifically due to heroin, but now we have a new character in the mix called fentanyl, which is 25 to 50 times more powerful than heroin. We are very in favor of the 7-day supply, and that is due to some of the newest research that came out in March that was provided by the University of Arkansas's Medical Services Department, that they, through their study, found that a 10-day script can translate to 1 in 5 chances of becoming a long-term user. The bottom line was they didn't really expect that. We know that opioid addiction is cunning, baffling, and powerful, but most unfortunately deadly. I want to thank everyone in the committee for working towards turning the tide and turning back the spigot on opioid pills, which can lead to deaths due to heroin users. So thank you very much for your time, and we are very supportive of all the amendments in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next, we'll go to Robin Menard. Robin, if you can state your name and affiliation for the record.
You bet. Hi, this is Robin Menard, and I serve as the Director of Public Affairs for the Mat-Su Health Foundation, which shares ownership in Mat-Su Regional Medical Center and invests its profits from that partnership back into the community to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in the Mat-Su. Here at the foundation, we strongly support SB 79. This legislation supports recommendations from the Alaska Opioid Policy Task Force, as well as the Mat-Su Health Foundation's Behavioral Health Environmental Scan, which called for adoption of strict guidelines for the prescribing of narcotics. The Behavioral Health Environmental Scan was commissioned by the foundation after a 2013 community health needs assessment found that all 5 of the top health goals articulated by our community were specifically related to behavioral health, which includes substance abuse. Since then, we've worked with local and statewide partners to look at ways to fill gaps in the behavioral health continuum of care while also looking upstream at prevention opportunities, of which this is one. We believe that SB 79 will save lives. In Alaska, in the last 2 years, first responders and emergency services personnel administered naloxone over 1,300 times for both confirmed and suspected narcotic overdoses, including way too many in the Mat-Su. 26 people died from heroin in Alaska last year and 83 from prescription opioids. The provisions of this legislation can help ensure that our statistics are better in the future. Limiting the amount of opioid drug that can be initially prescribed, requiring training for prescribers, and fully utilizing the prescription drug monitoring program will help ensure that all Alaskans have the opportunity for a healthy life. Many people occasionally need assistance dealing with pain, but when they do, it should be according to established best practices with the long-term health and safety of the patient in mind. We believe that SB 79 contributes to this goal. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Menard. Next up, we have David Reese.
For the record, this is David Reese of Eagle River. I'm also speaking for my son, Betsy, and my son, and my wife, Betsy, and my son, Joshua. In an email to the committee members, we provided some personal background for the issues that we see with the bills regarding prescriptions and licenses. As we described in the email, my son has been on a chronic pain management protocol for nearly 30 years with diagnoses and treatments defined by physicians in several major clinics across the U.S., and no other treatment than an opioid medication has allowed him to function. I'd just like to underscore the points that we made in the email. We highly support the intentions of the state to curb the misuse, abuse, and escalation of the opioids, but it's essential to protect those in chronic pain. Our concern from our family's perspective is that there is a context absent in the bill that people who have chronic pain and utilize legal medications like opioids need to be protected in terms of access to the medications and to providers of pain management plans. As our son has found aversion by pharmacies and insurance companies to providing the medications has increased dramatically in the past few years. While not solely an Alaskan issue, currently, for example, only one pharmacy in Anchorage is willing to provide our son's medication, and the Medicare insurance company presents an annual multi-step reapproval process as well as a pushback on reimbursements. One of the things that the consequences of this bill may be, as Senator Vega said, an increase to the cost for the patients. And that's the last thing that we want to see happen for those folks who need to have the opioids or the other medications for that pain management. There's one of those regulations that needs to make it easier to do the right things, but more difficult to do the wrong things. And I, again, highly endorse a lot of the things that are in the bill, but there are some considerations that might need to be made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Next up is Tracy Weiss. If you can state your name for the record and any affiliation.
Yes, my name is Tracy Weiss, W-I-E-S-E, co-chair of the Alaska or Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Alliance.
You may begin when ready.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I will also keep my comments short. In general, I'd like to just say again, as has been echoed before, thank you to everybody that's worked on this bill, all of us within the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Alliance, which is a group that represents all four subspecialties of advanced practice nurses. So this includes nurse anesthetists, clinical nurse specialists, nurse practitioners, and certified nurse midwives, are supportive of the majority of the bill. We do have some concerns about some of the language in the bill. First of all, we would like to acknowledge that we do support Senator Giesel's suggested amendment to ensure that nurse practitioners are listed specifically as licensed individual practitioners. And also, the concerns from our group revolve around the educational requirement. Some people have raised a concern that as the language is written now, the way it's describing the education is for opioids and addictions and recovery, or I don't have the exact language in front of me. So there's concerns from some members of our group that that language could be interpreted as the provider needing education in all three of those areas rather than one or the other. So that is our concern. Our other concern, being an organization that represents lots of different types of providers, is we have concern about undue burden of sole proprietor providers, providers who have small businesses, providers who don't have a front desk or any licensed personnel to delegate checking to. I'll use myself as an example. I'm a mental health provider, and I write several C2 prescriptions a day, none of them being opiates. I don't have a front desk, and I don't have a licensed person in my office to delegate that task to. So then I'm going to now be responsible for checking a database anywhere from 10 to 15 times a day, which would be all total about 45 minutes of my time in a day. And for some of us, that may be an undue burden. And so we didn't know if we could suggest language that specifically states, opiates rather than controlled to schedule a specific scheduled drug, whether it could be stated that it was specifically for opiates. And the other suggestion for our group is perhaps adding a sunset clause on the educational requirement so that we have the opportunity to look at this issue in the upcoming years to see if this legislatively mandated educational requirement is necessary for providers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I think that's everyone online. Is there anyone else in the room here in Juneau like to testify? Please come to the podium, state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wilson, and thank you to the committee members for hearing this bill. My name is Tom Chard. I'm the director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, so these are all your mental health and drug and alcohol providers across the state. We've got about 60 members, tribal, non-tribal, that serve kids and adults in every corner of the state. we see the devastating impacts of this crisis, and we help folks recover and meet recovery. We appreciate the leadership that the governor, the department, and you guys, the legislature, have paid to this epidemic, because we see it affecting individuals, families, and communities throughout our state. In particular, today I wanted to acknowledge our appreciation for the prevention and early intervention approach that this legislation is taking. A lot of times, as treatment providers, we're right at the tail end of the problem, and this legislation definitely addresses a little bit earlier upstream effect. You heard Dr. Butler talk about the prescription limits, the predictive capabilities of the prescription drug monitoring program. I wanted to spend a little bit of time on the continuing education requirements. As a brief aside, I happened to be talking with an individual in recovery last week. She went to her dentist to have some pretty significant dental work done and was terrified in trying to balance the pain and pain management with her recovery. I think that the continuing education requirements for prescribers will help those situations. I mentioned last week I was speaking with this individual. I was up in Anchorage for our annual school on addictions and recovery, where we had about 400 substance use counselors from across the state gather to learn about cutting edge approaches and some of the latest research and how to apply it for our folks here in Alaska. This week, we've got Bartlett Hospital bringing up somebody with Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration to talk about medication-assisted treatment, and specifically to talk about chronic pain management in populations where there's recovery concepts. So I appreciate that our behavioral health providers are bringing this to the forefront, and I think that we could absolutely benefit from this as a whole in our providers. So thank you for supporting this legislation, and thank you for your ongoing support of our response to this crisis. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Anyone else here in the audience in Juneau? Seeing and hearing none, we will close public testimony. Do we have any amendments for?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just in looking at the bill, I noted that if you turn to page 6, line 26, though this is repeated multiple places in the bill, it calls out AS 1171-140. This identifies Schedule 1A controlled substances, which contain opioids in that list. But also in 1171-160, that's Schedule 3A, there are also opioids identified. So simply for completeness, Mr. Chairman, I offer the amendment which adds Statute 1171-160 to the line that identifies the schedules that contain opioids. I have consulted with Dr. Butler on this, and he acknowledges that this additional section does contain opioids as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a technical point.
Senator Baggage.
I'm not sure we ever move the legislation itself before we move an amendment. Don't we have to have the legislation before us?
Not if we're first hearing.
Oh, it's because it's first hearing? Thank you.
So I move my objection.
Well, any other discussion?
Oh, that's true.
At ease, Mr. Chairman.
At ease. Back on the record. Any other questions for any other discussion for Amendment 1? Right. Do we still have an objection?
No, I remove my objection.
Right. Hearing no other further objection, Amendment 1 passes. Do we have any other further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment number 2.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you turn to page 21, line 18, this section refers to optometry. It refers to their continuing education requirements, which are identical to the other clinicians in this bill. However, on line 18, it says that in the 4 years preceding the application for renewal, all the professional licensees renew every 2 years. And so this very old piece of statute needs to be updated to reflect every 2 year license renewal. It does, in effect, double the amount of continuing education that is identified in this bill, but that's not a problem either.
Okay. Any discussion? Amendment?
I remove my objection.
Right. Any other objection? Hearing none, Amendment 2 passes. Are there any other further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment number 3.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 1, line 7, that is not the location. Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. I am going to, actually, this amendment has an error in it, but that's okay. We'll correct it. It's actually, the amendment should say on page 6, page 6, line 15. Perhaps it doesn't need to say that. Here's what I'm addressing. Is on page 6, line 15, a statute is identified, AS 1171-900. This statute, again, is in the Controlled Substances section of criminal law, just as the identification of those two schedules for drugs were. This is the definition section, and it calls out the definition of the word practitioner. And in the definition, which you see identified here in the amendment being inserted into Section 31, advanced practice registered nurse is left out of the definition of a practitioner. So as you can see on the printed amendment you have right here, a practitioner means a physician, dentist, advanced practice registered nurse is added, veterinarian, scientific investigator, other person. So essentially this is updating the definition of practitioner in criminal law under controlled substances.
Any questions or discussion for this?
I have a
Senator Michicki.
I have a question. So essentially it becomes a conceptual amendment?
No, actually, what I was calling out, and erroneously so, the first place that this appears in the bill is on page 6, line 15. You see on line 15, it says, there has the meaning given in AS 1171-900. So I said, what does the definition say? So I looked it up. The drafter chose to insert this amendment, which is amending the definition of practitioner, into Section 31, then renumber the rest of the bill sections accordingly. So my mistake for saying that the amendment was drafted incorrectly.
I got you.
Logistically, it seemed incorrect.
So,
Senator Michicki.
Mr. Chairman, so this is actually replacing the old Section 31, and then the new section, the old Section 31 will become Section 32 since it's renumbered accordingly.
That is correct. Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Michicki, that is correct.
And for clarification.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a title change is then that very first piece. It's just part of the title change.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion on Amendment number 3?
I remove my objection.
Any other objection to Amendment number 3? Hearing none, seeing none, Amendment 3 passes. Senator Von Imhoff.
I move Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 79, Labor and Commerce, Version O as an Oscar, as amended, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection? Hearing none, seeing none. Oh, Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I appreciate Senator Michiki identifying the deficiency, or appears to be deficiency, related to veterinarians, and so I look forward to him addressing that appropriately in the Senate Finance Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Michiki.
And I just, since we're probably going to adjourn immediately afterward, I just I appreciate this legislation. I was home for a day, and I went to the Freedom House grand opening, which is a project by a young woman who had a severe addiction for many years. And all I can say is it's an amazing facility. She's an amazing young woman. But what I want to highlight is it's so easy to become addicted to opioids, but so impossibly difficult to turn your life around. So if this gets in the way of a single Alaskan, which I hope it has a much more substantial effect, even though there's an inconvenience to providers, I strongly support this legislation. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We will have a moment for brief comments afterwards, but Senator Begich.
I just wanted to clarify that I'll be writing amend based on the comments from Senator Michiki, but I'm supportive of the legislation, and I do want to make comments at the end of the
Okay. Yes. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. We're back on the record, and just for clarification, I just want to make sure, hearing and seeing no objection, the bill did move from committee. With that, are there any other closing member comments as we conclude our business for the HES committee? Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I wanted to also echo my support of the legislation, but also in particular because in my family, two of my nephews are opiate addicts, and the inability of them to break that cycle is shocking to me. One of them has been in the correctional system, has taken advantage of the drugs that are provided. I'm trying to remember the name of it, Vivitrol, which has been successful. And for a year after he's out, he'll be able to get his Vivitrol prescription, and then it will run out. It'll be $1,200 a month, and he will not be able to pay it, so he'll become an addict again. I've actually spoken to him recently. He's going to do everything he can to keep that from happening, but that is an inevitable problem with addiction if you can't stop the process. So if this does what I hope Senator Michiki and I both believe, that if it stops anybody from ever entering the system, it saves not just lives, but just it saves our culture. It saves everything about what we value. And for me, this is very deeply personal. I want to just encourage us to get this thing through as fast as we can and stop the cycle of addiction. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Any other members' comments? Senator Geisel.
Well, I would just add an encouraging note. The research evidence does tend to favor that after a year to 16 or 18 months on Vivitrol, actually the cycle can be broken, and certainly with strong family support, such as your relatives have, there is a high likelihood that they will emerge successful. So anyway, just a comment.
I appreciate the administration's support and trying to curb any way we can this epidemic throughout our communities and homes. I don't think there is not one Alaskan that this epidemic has not touched in some way, shape, or form, of whether increased cost of their taxes to pay for law enforcement or knowing someone personally or dealing with some type of issues related to this. And so thank you for the folks here today that came out to testify and come to the committee, and those on the phone that came to testify, and those members in the other body that are also working on these issues to help stem this. And with that, we are adjourned at 5:06 p.m. on this wonderful sunny day.